Hi, this is Nora Williams, producer and editor of Found Dead with Christine Levine. We're still hard at work getting our second season together for you, but in the meantime, here's a little treat. We've collected all the episodes featuring Rick into one omnibus episode. You remember Rick. He found seven dead bodies. Well, now you can listen to him tell his whole story without a break. We hope you enjoy, and before we get going, if you want your story featured on the next season of Found Dead, we're still accepting submissions. Just email us at founddeadpod@gmail.com. Okay, that's enough for me. Take it, Christine.
This podcast features detailed descriptions of real dead bodies. Listener discretion is advised. I'm Christine Levine, and you're listening to Found Dead.
My name is Rick, and I found six dead bodies. He looked murdered. Something instinctually said to me, there's something wrong. She was blue. He's dead, dead, dead.
I sat down with my friend Rick at my house in Arizona. Rick is a native of Tucson. He is a queer rights activist and co-founder of Tucson Queer Story, an archive project preserving the story and long history of the queer community in Tucson, Arizona. Rick and I became friends before I ever heard his story. It's not very often that I find someone like me who has found more than three bodies. And at that point, I just say multiples. It drew us closer. Like, he knew something about me, and I knew something about him. We understand each other. I think that's the best way to put it. And also, like me, his first was when he was very young. His story begins in Tucson, Arizona, in 1975.
When I was two, my sister died. We were in my grandparents' home, and we were taking a nap. We had each our own cribs. I was older. She was 8 months old. There was sort of a ritual when I would wake up, I would climb out and climb to her and we would play until somebody came to get us. Opposite, if she would wake up first, she would throw her toys until I woke up. So obviously that afternoon, which happened to be my grandfather's birthday, I woke up, climbed out of my crib, climbed up onto hers. And from what I know, from what I've been told, she was blue and dead. And something instinctually said to me, there's something wrong. And I screamed and I fell on top of her, which made me scream more. And so then my mom comes in the room to see what's going on. And then sort of the rest is history at that point. This was in 1975. 911 wasn't a thing yet. She called zero, said she needed help. She had me in one hand, my sister Pam in the other hand. We're out on the front porch and a police car pulls up. He comes up, he grabs my sister and just leaves. And so we're just standing there. I have no idea what's going on. I don't remember that, but I know for a fact that it was trauma. What I remember is a week later, at 2.5, almost 3 years old, I remember being in a limousine with my mom and my grandmother and my grandfather. And I'm sitting on the seat that faces backwards with my arm on top of a casket. The casket was probably 29, 30 inches long, little ice chest, my mom calls it, little white ice chest. And I remember that, and I know I remember it, and it's not something that somebody told me because I said it out loud first, and the shock on my grandmother's face that I just talked about it on my own. I think I was about six, and I said something like, I think we had gone to another funeral, and I said, how come when Pammy died, she didn't have her own car? And she said, what are you talking about, basically? And I said, she rode in the car with us and that person didn't. I think it was my grandfather's sister that passed away or something. And that person had their own car and people carried the casket. That was different. Like my grandfather, I believe, carried my sister's casket by himself. And then she said, I can't believe you know that. Nobody's ever, you know, it wasn't a conversation anybody had.
So all of a sudden, at 6 years old, you pop off and you're just like, what? You have these questions. And what did they say? Did they answer you or?
Well, my grandmother was super open with me.
Yeah.
I mean, if we want to go back a couple more years before that, before I was born, my uncle was murdered. So it started then in my family. So he was killed. And so my grandmother was suffering an immense amount of trauma when my sister died. And now then my mom is suffering the same trauma my grandmother is. The sad part about my sister's story is that nobody, she died of SIDS. We should get that on there. Back then, they didn't call it SIDS. They called it crib death. She had an autopsy. There was a full investigation. That's what it was. But the media got involved. There was a banner headline in the newspaper that said, "What killed baby Pamela?" in 3-inch black, bold print. There was media in front of the house. People would call the house and say, "Baby killer," and hang up. Stuff like that. So on top of losing this little precious child, there's this on top of it. On the heels of my grandfather being sort of an influential person, of all of the press from my uncle, who was a quarterback football player, being killed within a few years of each other. And you go back and you look at the history, it's kind of simple how it happened. They were at the hospital, and the two detectives that were the homicide detectives that were working my uncle's case came to console my family. Somebody saw that and knew that they were homicide detectives and tipped off media to say something else is going on here. My mom was all of 19 years old at this point.
Oh my God.
So the rumors around town were, first my mom killed her, then I at 2 years old killed her. So you would just start piling trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma.
Everybody was like, it sounded like the community was just re-victimizing your mother and your family.
And my mom went to California for a while, so I was with my grandmother. It just was just mass insanity at that point.
Do you know if she ever got counseling or treatment or anything like that for...
She did.
Yeah.
Much later. She also, with her friend Jenny, created a nonprofit or worked with a nonprofit that's still around called Compassionate Friends, and it's about for parents that lost children. That was her therapy. In where we live for a lot of years, when a child would die in our community, her and Jenny were the contact points for whoever was helping the family, whether it was, you know, a child died from violence or SIDS or whatever, drowning. So my mom and her friend Jenny, who was a nurse, would respond to these scenes with these families.
Oh my God.
And sit with the families and help them and then bring them into the support groups and stuff like that. So that was how my mom was helping herself.
Did you get any counseling when you were little?
No.
Or did they get any treatment for you?
No. I think they just thought I just didn't remember. And I think their way of dealing with it was just not talked about. My grandfather was a strange man. Within 24 hours of my sister's death, everything that was hers was gone.
What?
He had eliminated everything. Everything was gone.
I swear to God, it's like this Protestant work ethic. My family is the same way. You know, somebody dies, there's some kind of tragedy in the family, and it's like, back to work. Let's go.
Yep.
We just put our boots on and keep fucking going.
Right.
And exactly. Let's walk it off.
Yeah. And the only thing we have just a few pictures of her. You know, we didn't have camera phones back then.
Yeah. And you didn't have
and
time.
A friend of my mom said babysat us a few days before, and we had left a pair of Pam's shoes at her house. So we have those pair of shoes and we have nothing else. And when she died, I had this little wind up bear and she had a wind up lamb. But at the same time, I still have my bear. Somebody went and replaced the lamb so he could bury it with her. Because my grandfather,
because he just scooped everything,
had somebody probably from his company come in and literally erase everything. Like it just didn't, never. She never existed.
I wonder if he thought he was helping your mother.
I think so.
I mean, it's easy to say like, oh, he thought he was hurting and he just was like, nope. But I really feel like he was probably.
And I think somewhere in his head, you know, she was only 8 months old. You know what I mean? She was just a baby.
No, you know that generation, they did feel that way.
Right.
I've talked to a lot of older people like that, like who would be maybe 100 or 90 right now. In my lifetime, I've talked to these people, and it really, death was something that you did just kind of march on with because it happened so often.
And they were still like mid-trial, like getting ready to go to trial for my uncle's murder. Yeah. So that was that they couldn't escape. Okay. And I don't know if he just could not. Maybe he couldn't handle the heaviness of it all on top of everything else. And and just, I don't know. He never answered the questions. He refused.
I'm sorry that happened. Do you guys still you celebrate her birthday?
Yes.
She's obviously got the tribute that is the nonprofit and stuff like that. That's fantastic that she lives on.
And through that nonprofit, my mom helped create a park. And it's called the Children's Memorial Park.
Oh.
And there's a wall, sort of, it's similar to like the Vietnam Memorial wall. So she's on that wall. Every birthday and anniversary, we celebrate her. Mm-hmm. We remember her. Once my mom passes on, which will be a long time, I hope, I'm the only one. Like nobody else knew her.
Mm-hmm.
My younger siblings were way after her. My older cousins never met her. So I have made a promise to my mom that as long as I'm alive, she won't be forgotten.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Oh my God, what a sad... That's always harder when babies, because they don't even get a chance to be assholes yet.
Right. You know what I mean? They don't get to turn three.
Somebody even dies when they're 30 and you're like, well, you were kind of a dick.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So next adult, well, young adult.
Uh-huh.
I think I was 18 or 19. I was living in the Tempe area outside of Phoenix. I was over with a friend and we were walking out to the car to go out and do something. And there was a young man who had been murdered next to the dumpster right next to where the car was parked.
Oh my God. Jesus. Ugh. Did it occur to you? And I've asked other people this. Did it occur to you at any time when you see there's obviously something happened and you could just be like, I'm not going to do anything about this?
We actually talked about whether we were going to do anything about this. Like, we were like, should we just leave? What should we do? And then the reality of the situation was there was some blood splatter on my friend's car. So we knew better. So that turned into a 911 call and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours.
Right. Because that's what I'm saying too. Like, now your day is ruined.
Yeah.
Your
3 days.
Oh, how long?
3 days. It was interrogation room. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And car gone, towed away. You know, stuff like that. It just was a complete and utter miserable experience. Like, didn't know the guy, never saw him before, didn't know, have any idea how that happened. If I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure he shot himself in the head.
Oh.
So they thought he was murdered. When we saw him, he looked murdered.
Right.
You know, I think if I remember right, that if you go, I think I'd have to go research it, but I think he killed himself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Did you ever feel any desire to
reach out?
Just find out who they were.
I think I just wanted to know what happened. Maybe just to cure the curiosity, like
right.
You know, like, well, what happened here? Like, this is such a weird anomaly, and we walked out to the car like 3 a.m. You know, and here's this mess. You know, I think I just wanted to know. I don't think I ever had it at that age, too.
Right, no.
I didn't have, like, any desire.
You don't really get philosophical about
it. Yeah, no, I was just like, that's gross. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And really? Like, with my family history, really?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Like, they wanted every detail of the day, where we were, what we did, and then they separated us. And they wanted to know every detail of the day. I mean, then it all just stopped. So I think they sort of figured out what happened or what they thought happened.
They tested his hands for gunshot residue.
Or whatever it was. Yeah. And they were like, and then it was like,
came in.
You know, and then it was very abrupt. Great. Have a good day. You can pick up your car tomorrow.
Oh my God. That almost makes me angry.
Yeah.
Because it was like, they bust your balls so hard.
Yeah. And they didn't even drive us back.
Oh.
We had to like get a ride back.
Oh my God.
So my friend's car is gone.
Right.
My car's at that apartment complex. We're miles away.
Not even a bus ticket.
Just hear it. It's 3 in the afternoon. You got here 10 hours ago. Bye. I told everybody I knew about it. You know, like, I was almost like, if I'm being honest, I kind of wore it as like this little badge of honor for a while because it got me attention. Mm-hmm. You know, and people like, oh, tell us the story, you know. So I think when you're 18 or 19 years old, you need attention. And if we go back a little bit for a second too, my grandmother was obsessed with death after my uncle died, obsessed with it.
I bet.
Like, to an extreme. Like, and so from, you know, age 2 up, when I was at her house, I couldn't go outside. Oh my God. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, right. She was obsessed.
Something could happen to you.
And she consistently with me, consistently, your sister died, my son died, like over and over. I can't wait to go to heaven and be with them. These things, my whole childhood, I would spend the weekend with her and we would go to the cemetery all day Saturday so she could polish headstones. Mm-hmm. And I'm this little kid running around a cemetery on a Saturday. And then we would go to Wiener Schnitzel. That was like our thing. And I didn't think it was strange until I was an adult.
That is so interesting. My grandmother was very much the same way. And I had a lot of what I used to call ancestor worship weekends.
Yes.
Which is my grandmother dragging me and the other grandkids up to the cemetery, buckets of soapy water. Mm. What is it with these old people and the World War II generation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And their obsession with death.
I don't know.
I mean,
we had copper headstones and she wore them down.
Oh, wow.
With polish, yeah.
That meant a lot to her.
Mean a lot to her. And now she's right there, right next to him with the same exact headstone he has.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So you have a family plot then that they all go
to. My sister's in a different part, in what they call Babyland. My mom regrets that now, but...
Yeah, I've seen these. I've always called them like a baby garden.
Right.
And all they sprout is those memorials to their babies.
And there's a statue of Jesus with little children on his lap in this area of the cemetery. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I know exactly the type you're talking about. Oh, my God. We got more to go through. Let's trudge on.
So this is when my life turns, right? So I've got all of this trauma in my life. Yes. And I've got all of these things I'm dealing with. And I end up going down a dark path myself. I have not had therapy. I don't understand who I am, what I'm about. I've been super sheltered. I've been riddled with death my whole life at this point. I end up getting myself in trouble legally, and I end up having to go to prison.
Oh my God.
So prison isn't a safe place either.
Mm-mm.
So we now end up in a violent place. And so here comes the next two. So body one, it's breakfast. Everybody's being let out to go eat breakfast. And a couple of, we called them rooms, the way it was set up, a couple of rooms down. We had our own keys. As long as everything was unlocked, we could go in and out as we pleased. The two gentlemen that lived two doors down from me, the one was coming back from work and went into the chow hall to eat. And I was on my way. And he said, "Did you see my celly?" And I said, "I haven't seen him." And he handed me his key and he said, "You go get him for me." Basically, he had smuggled some stuff, you know.
Oh, okay.
And he didn't go get him for me. I said, "Sure." So I ran back up the stairs and I popped the door and I looked in and he's dead, dead, dead.
Ah!
And I was like, "Ugh."
God damn it.
And he's on the top bunk and he's arm out, blue, spotted, dead. And I was like, "Yeah, here we go."
So do you think, did the guy set you up to go find him?
No, this was an OD.
It was an OD.
Yeah. So no, he didn't. He just was wondering where, because he was supposed to meet him at the chow hall to grab whatever he was supposed to grab. And he wasn't there. His celly, the one that didn't die, he didn't want to cross the yard with whatever he had.
I see.
See? So I had to go. He asked me if I could go get him.
What happens when somebody dies in a prison?
Tell somebody and then it's just everything's locked down. So you know as you're walking towards a CO that you're about to get the whole complex locked down for as long as you can imagine. You know what I mean? And you know that's about to happen.
You know everything's going to get locked down. You're not going to, do you go buy some ramen first or something? you're just like, I gotta get ready for this or mentally prepare yourself. Or did you do, again, the dutiful thing? Well,
I went and found a celly first. Uh-huh. And I said, I don't want to say any names, but I said, "Dude's dead." He said, "What?" I said, "Your celly's dead, man. I don't know why." And I think I said, "Did you do something to me?"
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And he's like, "No." And he, "Oh, fuck." And I'm like, "Yeah." And I said, "So you want to go deal with it? Or you want me to say something? What do you want done?"
Yeah. What's the next play?
And he's like, "You should, because I have this stuff."
Because I cannot.
Right. So I just walked up to the officer that was in the kitchen and I said, "Hey, dude, in room whatever. I think he's dead. I got a look like, come on, because we're all liars,
Yeah.
So I got this look like, come on. I said, "No, seriously, I'm pretty sure he's dead." And he said, "Okay." And he radioed it. And then it was lockdown.
And then all of a sudden, bells and whistles.
Bells and whistles, lockdown, get in your rooms right now. Cops coming from every corner. Yeah.
ODs aren't too bad.
Mm-mm.
You know what I mean? As far as being graphic.
Yeah, there's nothing real graphic about it. He'd just been there all night long and stuff had settled. Yeah, yeah.
The color,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't see his face.
Oh, good.
I saw his arm, yeah.
But and then, just the arm, though.
Yeah, I could tell by the arm. And it was in a weird, weird position. It was kind of hanging down. I was like, yeah, nothing about this is right.
Do you think that when you enter a space where there's somebody dead in it, that it feels different?
Absolutely.
Isn't that weird?
It feels like, for me, it feels like a vacuum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like this weird spot now. It's a spot now. And I'm sure it's all psychological, but yeah, it's like it does. It feels like a vacuum.
But
like that air has been sucked out of the room.
Yeah. But even before you know.
Right.
There's something different about the area.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know what that is, but when you go into a room where everybody's alive, everything's alive.
Mm-hmm.
It feels a certain way. And then when you walk into a room where somebody is not alive, something is not alive,
mm-hmm.
like your dog or whatever, even that can happen. And
absolutely.
You just feel it.
Yeah, I think maybe we're programmed to know.
Yeah.
To be like, oh, stop.
Right. The connection to, I hate to get woo-woo about it, but I just don't know how else to process that.
Right.
That feeling. And there's something about, like, they're too still.
Yeah.
When I was a young mother, I would watch my baby sleep because, you know, just in case.
Just in case.
Right?
Yeah.
Crib death and lava were two things that I was terrified of. And quicksand, you know what I mean? That's, right. I thought, oh God, my whole life is going to be riddled with crib death, lava, quicksand, I'm dead. I watched a lot of Gilligan's Island and had also a fascination with things dying. There is just that stillness. But when I was watching my kids breathe, even if they didn't take a breath right away or when I thought they should, and the thought would occur to me, oh God, I still knew. It wasn't the same as when I saw my grandmother.
Right.
It was not that same feeling of, you know, you just know they're alive.
Right.
That was a weird feeling. So, like, even when you walked in, just even, like, the placement of his body, like, you're just taking it all in, going, nope.
Mm-mm. And the fact that when I knocked, he didn't respond.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't just walk in.
He could have had a stroke.
Yeah.
And still been alive.
Right.
But you know.
But you know. And then, of course, it came to, why did you go up there? Why did you have that key? What was going on? You know?
Oh.
Yeah. So, dude had to, like, kind of come clean about it. Because I'm like, you're not getting me in trouble for this. So.
Right, right.
Yeah.
God, I you know, it's weird. I have met a few people that have found multiple bodies that like me. It's not often. Like, it's pretty rare. And I had this idea that maybe people like you and people like me are, for, I mean, I don't want to get too woo-woo about it, but maybe this is like our call, like, this is what we do. We absorb trauma. We're like the dogs of the world. We absorb the trauma for everybody else so that they don't have to do it.
Right.
Imagine if somebody more fragile had found some of the bodies that you've had.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And isn't it great? I mean, it's not great, but in a way, I feel like, in my cases anyway, I know that the people who could have found those bodies were even less equipped than I was.
Right, to deal with it.
To deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel that way? Or what is your philosophy on this?
I never thought about it that way. I just thought it was a curse, honestly, that it was just some kind of magnetic force. You know, I have that electronic curse too, where if I touch electronics first, they break.
Right.
So I just thought that somehow these things were attracted to me. And since the first one I found was when I was so young.
Yeah, that's usually how it goes, by the way. The people that I'm talking to that have found multiple bodies, like, and I'm talking 5, 6, 7, 8, and they don't work in a mortuary, and they don't go hiking a lot.
Mm-mm.
They just are regular folks that keep running into death over and over and over again. Those people usually have started when they're children.
Right.
I did. You did. I mean, 10 and under.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Almost always.
Always.
Like, you don't think, is there not a purpose to it, or?
Well, I think that maybe now that you said it, I haven't thought about it that way ever. Because more often than not, I try not to think about it.
How are we all holding up? 3 down, 3 more to go. And can I confess something to you? Halfway through this interview, even I had to take a break. So I know you do too.
Coming up next.
Chest open, completely bled out. Call the police, there's a lady out here dead. And as I passed him, he ran right behind my car and got hit by a van. His head is gone.
Hi, Christine here. I just wanted to come in and say that if you have been enjoying our show, we'd love it if you would go to your podcast app of choice and leave us a 5-star review and share our episodes on social media. It'll help new people find our show so that we can keep bringing you great stories of finding dead bodies. It's just the way everyone wants to start their Friday morning. And now back to the show. Beginning as only a toddler and finding his infant sister passed away in her crib and stretching all the way through to an OD in prison, anyone could agree that Rick has probably seen enough. But life isn't like that. And Rick still had more bodies out there waiting for him.
Body number 4, a few years later.
A few years later, still in prison.
Still in prison, different place, different setup. There was a lot of tension going on. And you can feel when there's tension, you kind of know things are happening. So the day before this, there was a ton of tension, a lot of activity on the yard, a lot of political activity on the yard. And then it was the next day. And again, was walking, like walking around the track with a friend. And as typical with me, I had to go to the bathroom. So I had to dip out to go to the bathroom. And I went to go and I opened a stall. And there's a gentleman who had very recently been stabbed to death.
Ugh, that's very violent.
It was very violent. It was very graphic. I mean, it was neck cut, head mostly severed, chest open, completely bled out. And the way the floor was set up, there was a drain. So it had like drained. So you couldn't see unless you were like looking down under things. You couldn't see. So it was quite a shock. That was the one time I'm like, I'm not doing anything about this.
You didn't do anything.
I didn't do anything.
Did you go to the bathroom?
I did not.
At that point, I was like, I know.
I had pushed it. I stood there for probably 4 seconds, and that's maybe being a little over exaggerating. I don't know. And I just let the door shut and I walked out the door.
Yeah.
And I told nobody for a long time.
Really?
Yeah.
At some point, they found the body.
Yes.
Well,
within about 15 minutes, somebody else had. But I never said that I was the first one in there. I didn't want to answer questions. I didn't want to talk to authorities about any of it.
Right.
I didn't want to be involved. And it was also somebody of another race, which makes a big difference in that situation.
That's just not anything that you want to deal with.
Nothing.
No.
Nothing to do with. I didn't tell anybody on the yard. I didn't tell any of my friends until months later.
The guy you were with, like, he knew you were headed to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did he ask you?
No.
No.
Oh, he didn't ask me. Did he ask me if I had known he was there?
Yeah. If, like, did you see?
I don't think he
put it together.
Put it together, no.
All you'd need is just one dude to place you
right
there.
Mm-hmm. And not necessarily an issue with authorities, but an issue with the inmates.
Yeah, his friends or whatever.
Whatever.
Do you have friends? In-
you do. You do. Absolutely. Yeah, you do. And sometimes it's really hard to walk away and leave them behind. Yeah, you bond heavy. You have to. You have to create a world of your own. You have to create a family of some sort.
Right.
You just have to. You don't have a choice.
And then so many people in prison, though, that's just trauma bonds. You know what I mean?
Yep, exactly.
And those are very tight.
They are.
Well, R.I.P.
Whoever you were.
Whoever you were. Oh, yeah. Man.
Sorry that happened to you. I never liked the idea of somebody dying there if they had an out date. If that makes sense. If they have a release date, I never liked seeing somebody not make their release date. It also makes you worry about your mortality.
Obviously, you're just like, I could be next. Mm-hmm. Or this could happen to me. I mean, he got stabbed, but you don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it was about?
I know now.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Can you tell me?
It was about drugs.
It was about drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to guess.
Yeah, it was about drugs.
Jesus.
Money owed.
I just can't imagine that in prison, the amount of money could have been a lot.
Oh, no. It was probably a few $100.
A few $100. That's what I mean.
But in there, a few $100 is a few thousand out here.
Did they catch anybody for doing that?
Yeah. Of course, people start to tell real quick.
yeah. That's the thing. Like, I find when I'm watching my little murder shows or whatever, almost always, it's not because the police did a great job.
No, it's never that.
No, it's because...
It's luck for the police.
It's luck. It's because people cannot...
Keep their mouth shut, or they take their phone with them to kill people. Yeah.
They take their phone with them. They can't keep their mouth shut. They just... It's not because the police were like, oh, no, we were really smart.
Yeah.
And we just figured it out.
Yeah, that doesn't...
No, it's because you got lucky. You got tipped off.
Right.
Because people, you know what I think? I think they love attention.
Yeah.
And it's that they just go, I know something you don't know.
Yep.
And cops are lucky.
So I get out, finally.
You get out. Congratulations.
Thank you. My case was a little convoluted. There was a lot of stuff that happened with that case that wasn't accurate. So once I was out and able to fight things, very quickly had stuff expunged and sealed and stuff like that. Years go by. Lots of years go by, I guess. I've got a real life job. I have a real life life. You know what I mean? And that stuff's in the past. And I don't think about it as often. At this point, I've been through my first year of two of PTSD therapy. I had to because I couldn't go into restaurants. I couldn't have my back to crowds, you know.
Yeah.
I couldn't
all
go
that
to,
trauma
I couldn't go to movies.
You from know. Being in prison.
Yeah.
Just left over. Holy
you can't. You can't. I mean, this is probably a different time, a different podcast someday, but you can't leave your eyes closed long. Even if you think you're the safest guy in the world, you're not. There's always somebody that doesn't like you.
Yeah, it would be just like being on high alert with a bunch of predators all the time.
Yeah, for 8 years, 6 months, and 12 days.
Whoa. Yeah, constantly. So what was the therapy that you said you had?
I had EMDR therapy.
What is that?
That's light and sound therapy. The great thing about this is I didn't have to rehash trauma. You just walk through remembering it to yourself, and there's lights and sound and vibration. And the goal of that therapy is to move these traumas, what my therapist called sunburns, to long-term memory rather than having it frontal lobe, recent memory. So trauma will sit right behind your eyeballs, basically. And every time you're triggered, it's like it's happening. So this therapy pushes that into long-term memory to help it be foggy and less easily. You have to work to retrieve those memories, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what that therapy was. And it was incredible. I purposely didn't like Google it before I started because I was told not to. And it's incredible. Like I can sit. The only reason I can sit here and talk to you about this is because of that therapy.
Oh, that's incredible. I want this now.
It's amazing.
I'm going to get that. That sounds great.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of it until you mentioned it. So you did get therapy, and this for prison, for all the trauma or just...
For all of it. I started the therapy, he said, let's just start from your very first sunburn. What do you think your first sunburn is? And I said, I think it's when my grandmother died. He goes, okay. And then he said, let's do just a little bit of family history. I talked about my sister, and he said, okay, listen, dude.
Right.
Listen, dude.
Don't trick yourself.
We need to go back, 20 years from there.
Absolutely.
From when your grandmother died. That's where we start.
He must have been like, holy shit. Kind of like me right now. He must have been like, oh my God.
If he was, he never showed it.
Oh, really?
He was a consummate professional.
I'm so glad.
Yes. He never showed it as much as I was waiting.
Yes.
For the, oh God, or the look, the look.
Oh, yeah.
And, he never did. So
I had a psychiatrist get his eyes welled up.
Yeah.
And that broke my heart. That made me feel worse.
Yes.
And I never saw him again.
I had a therapist right before this therapist that happened too. Not that it matters, but my trauma therapist was a man. Uh-huh. But my therapist was a woman. And I just don't think she could handle it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was connection to child stuff. I don't know.
Well, they've got their own.
They got their own stuff. And
you know?
She's the one that said, I can't do this with you because it was too much for her. Then you go, oh my God, what's wrong with me? You know?
That too. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that's when I was referred to true. Because I was like, oh, PTSD is for soldiers. You know, this isn't. And then they're like, no, come on. Mm-hmm. You know, let's go do this. You need to do this. And I do.
Yeah, I think PTSD, I agree with you. I feel like there's a little, I feel like when I say I've got PTSD, like, oh, that's a little stolen valor for me. Mm-hmm. I don't like it either.
Or you're being dramatic.
Or you're dramatic, yeah. Because there's so much stuff that didn't happen to me.
Right.
That has happened to other people mm-hmm. that have had it way worse.
Yeah.
And I just feel like, oh, we can't equate these two things. Right. But it isn't. The trauma is, did it fuck you up?
Right.
And if it did, that's trauma.
And let's be honest.
That's it.
Prison is a war zone.
It always is. Absolutely.
It is. It's a war zone, whether you're an inmate or a cop, a CO. And you're always at war with the authority if you're an inmate.
Yeah.
You're always at war racially. You're always at war with people trying to have power.
There's no safety.
There's
no
safety.
At any time.
At any time.
For 8 years.
6 months and 12 days.
Well, thank God you got the therapy that you needed and it worked.
Well, then this happened.
And then, yeah. And then there was more.
Then there was more.
Body number five.
So I'm an insurance adjuster at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, got my life together. Can pass background checks, you know.
Yay!
And I'm going to Sierra Vista to do my job. And I stop right along the highways where they meet there in Sierra Vista. There's like a truck stop there. I can't remember what it's called. And I pull in there and I park my car and I'm going to go in. And as I get out of my car, I don't like door ding, so I park way out always. So I parked my car and I was going to go in and I kind of glanced over towards the little tree line. And I went, oh no. I went, oh no. And I kind of looked and I'm like, fuck. And it was a homeless woman under the tree with her little stuff all around her, tongue out, Pale as can be, dead.
Oh my God. There goes your day.
There goes my day. There goes an extra 6 months of therapy.
Yeah. Oh my God. And you again. Bless you. You did the right thing.
I went to the bathroom first this
Good
time.
Good for you. Because she's not going to get
She's not going to get undead.
Nope.
Nope. She's dead.
That bun has been baked.
Yes.
You cannot uncook it.
And this time I walked up to the lady in the store and I said, can you call the police? There's a lady out here dead. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to use my phone. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like I wanted separation. Again, there's that look. She didn't want to do it till she saw for herself. So she walked with me. Then she freaked out.
Uh-huh.
This young girl freaks out. And so I'm like, well, now she's going to have trauma.
Right. But now you've got a story and now you've got trauma. You're welcome.
Yeah.
You
should have just called the police like I asked you.
I mean, it's not funny because it's happened to her, but we've been there. We know.
Right.
And you're right. She should have just called the police like you told her, but no.
No. I got to go see if this guy's a liar. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And again, there I am, 6-7 hours.
And they take your statement.
Take my statement. Have to write it all down.
Why are you here? Where are you from?
They wanted my car to stay where it was so they could take pictures because they didn't know how she died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was unattended. You know, so to make sure she wasn't murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They, you know, wanted my DNA swab.
That is so undignified.
It is.
Just to be treated like that.
And I even said my DNA is in the system.
Right. You can find it.
You just go find it.
Look it up. Did you ever find out anything about this woman?
Nothing at all. I like looked to see if there was like newspaper stuff, but she was homeless. Nobody cared.
Unfortunately, that is how it happens.
Nobody cared.
I mean, sometimes they can't even find their families. I don't even know if they try. I know that in Tucson, there is a group of people that will try to find the family members of immigrants that have crossed the desert and passed away in the desert.
Yeah. And it had snowed. It had snowed the night before. So maybe she froze. I don't know.
I don't know
how old she was. Don't know. Yeah.
How old did she look?
She looked to be about 50, I would say.
So she's probably 30.
Probably 30.
I mean, the road looks rough on, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember the cardboard sign that was laying next to her. I couldn't see the words. I just remember it laying on the ground.
Oh, so she had been out busking.
On the on-ramp.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's nice of you that you stayed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you waited for the cops to come and you did your whole, your whole bit.
Yeah, because I guess I know that if I just left and somebody wrote down my license plate number or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, that's a lot more drama. Let's just get it out of the way now.
All over with. Put it behind you. Make a phone call. Get more therapy.
Right. Yeah. Hey, guess what?
God, that's so crazy. Yeah. You just think like, okay, this is behind me. Mm-hmm. I'm moving forward. My life is good.
Right.
And
hopefully all of it will be like hospice related with parents or whatever. You know what I mean? And
The death from now on is going to be
normal. Right.
And able to handle it. And surrounded by loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
The right way.
One more.
All right.
It was about 2 years after that. Same job.
Uh-huh.
So I'm out driving all day. I'm heading down a road in Tucson, and there's a gentleman that had ran across the road and stopped in the median. And as I passed him, he ran right behind my car and got hit by a van.
Oh, my God.
And he got thrown. I hit the brakes. I saw it in the mirror. I hit the brakes. He got thrown so far forward. I get out of my car as soon as I can, and I go to help him, and his head is gone.
What?
It's just a watermelon, basically, everywhere. And this 17-and-a-half-year-old girl was driving this old beat-up minivan. It just obliterated this man. I realized I had stepped on stuff.
You stopped.
I got out of my car.
You were just like...
I stopped.
You want to help
I also her. Have a dash cam in my car all the time.
Oh.
So I had him in my camera.
Right.
And I remember when the police came, they took my camera and I never got they took the footage. I didn't get to keep it or anything. But anyway, so I was like, oh, I need to get it out of this brain matter, you know, and And then I needed to keep her out of it.
So you did. Did you keep her from looking or?
I said, yeah, she tried to come and I said, just go that way.
Uh-huh.
Just go that way. And she had a kid in the car. And I'm like, go that way and take yourself and that child far away from here. By happenstance, there was a fire truck in a parking lot nearby that had heard the accident. And they came out really fast. They were like ran over.
My first feeling about this is that is disgusting.
It was pretty gross.
That is really gross. So you had his brains on your shoes?
On my shoes, yeah.
Did you throw your shoes away?
No. I don't think I threw. No. I think I was, I remember I was, it was by the park, the big park in the middle of town there. And I just went over and like on the grass.
Just wiped your shoes.
But I didn't want to get it in my car.
What are you supposed to do?
I didn't want to put it in my car.
No. You love your car. You have nice cars. And it is a weird, there's like this a practicality. Mm-hmm. You think like, oh, this brain, that's a treasure to somebody. You know, that's his family and his, well, they got to bury him with it. Well, no, not all of it.
No, because the fire truck just used their hoses and washed it down the street. Yeah.
They don't scoop it.
Oh, no. Once they took the body out, they just got the hoses off the fire truck and just rinsed it all into the storm drains.
Whoa. And did that cost you your day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What was that?
I remember texting my family and being like, I'm stuck. I'm not going anywhere. My car's stuck on this road. Like, they're not going to let it go. Like, I'm screwed. They took my dash cam. I'm done. I even had to call work and I'm done.
Right. You're just done for the day.
Yeah.
You witnessed an accident.
And I needed to call my therapist.
Speed dial. It happened again.
Yeah. It's almost a shrug of the shoulders at this point. Meh.
Yeah. And it's funny that you just know the drill now. Mm-hmm. You know the phone call. You know how much time this is going to take.
Yeah.
You're like, here's my fingerprints. Here's my, okay, whatever you need. Yes, yes, yes. Fine. Do the police ever offer any kind of counseling or sympathy or how are they ever towards you? Were they ever kind?
No.
No.
Not one time. Even the firefighters at that last scene, I was in the way. But no, they're never nice. They're like, it's a burden for them. And they don't care how you feel about it. They see this crap all day, every day. So for them, it's just, this is what we do. This is the choice of profession. This is what we do. So in my opinion, they don't give a crap about how you feel about it. That's on you. I don't know how you're going to get home, but.
Deal with it. You'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
You're a big boy.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny that, you know, they don't ever say that all firemen are bastards, but they might be too. Who knows?
They were super nice to that girl that hit the guy.
Good.
Like they were really careful with her, but she was hysterical.
Right.
I wasn't. I was stoic, I guess, or just like I said, And then I was like, I got to stop looking at this. Like, I got to quit staring. I want to be completely honest about this. There was a compulsion to get my phone out and take pictures. I don't know if it was to prove I was there.
Uh-huh.
Or just because I had the ability.
Yeah.
And I had to force it down and not do that.
I admire that.
Others were taking pictures.
I bet they were.
But I made a choice not to. I had to fight the compulsion to not do it. But then it was on the news and my car was on the TV. Oh. So I was like, well, there's that. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, so you're married.
I am married.
And you go home to your husband. And what is that conversation like?
Well, I mean, he had been texted through the whole thing, you know, and my mom too.
I'm sure he's worried about you, though,
because
he knows what you've been through.
Yes. And I think he's a little more sensitive than I am. I'm careful. I'm very careful with the details. Even in my history, like I saw my uncle's whole murder book. I found it by accident when I was like five.
How has this affected your views on death? Do you have any thoughts about the afterlife?
Oddly enough, my husband and I talked about this yesterday because I was coming to do this. My whole life, I've been mortified and terrified to die. Obviously, can attribute that to my grandmother's behavior. I'm older now. I'm not feeling that as much as I used to. I used to, if I just thought for half a second about my own death, I'd get anxiety and I would get sick to my stomach and I would get scared. And I don't know exactly why. But as I'm getting older and slower and sore, I feel like it might be a little more, it's a less scary now. I don't know why I'm so scared of it.
I understand that. I used to be the same way, very, very terrified. And I don't even want to think about it. Or I even would think like, there's got to be a way. I got to have a way out of it.
Right.
Like, I'd be the first one to not do this.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it.
Yeah, me too. Like, how do I avoid it?
But now as I get older and my joints hurt and stuff and I've been sick, I've gone, oh, now I get it.
Right.
Now I know why it's okay.
Yeah.
Because you get sick of it.
You get sick of it. Yeah.
You're just like, fuck it.
Yeah. And I often ask myself, do I want to go like in an instant, in an accident or something? Or would I, do I want to be sick?
That was my next question.
And I think I kind of think I want to be sick. Because I think I want to feel that, okay, I'm ready to do this, that other people have told me about, which means that's not how I'm going to die, right? I mean,
right. But nobody gets what they want.
They never get what you want. And I'm, because of my life, I am a control freak. I have to control my environment at all times. You can't control it.
No.
You just can't control it. And I know that from my experiences that you just can't control it. And that's the scary part, right? Like, you just never know. And poof. Sometimes I just feel like I don't get it. Why are we here? What are we doing? What's the point? And then I have to try to find purpose in it all. And because of my trauma and time I lost in my life, I find myself consistently beating myself up and being like, I can't change it. And it's hard for me to be happy. People often ask me, well, what do you do for fun? I don't have an answer for that. I don't know. We do lots of fun things. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what joy feels like.
You still can't relax.
I can't relax. I just don't know what, just a moment of pure, I mean, I had one of the most beautiful weddings ever and I was controlling it, you know, like, and it was sort of in a public space and I was worried about what might happen. I go to the movies, I sit in the very back row so I can see everything. I go to a restaurant, anywhere, I have to see the doors. Like, I have to be facing doors. So your life becomes a series of rituals. That's how I cope. Even though the PTSD therapy was amazing, he said, and it's true, you're not going to get rid of all of it. You'll be stuck with rituals. You just will. There's no way around it. Like, and those are the ways that you survive, emotionally survive.
Yeah.
And that one time I have my back to the door, is that when that crazy mass shooter is going to walk in, you know, and I can't get my husband under the table fast enough, or I can't take the bullet or whatever. And when I have my nieces and nephews, I'm terrified. What if something happens? Mm-hmm. You know, I can't let anything happen.
But you are so loving and so kind, and you're just an amazing friend.
Thank you.
I love you so much. And I'm sorry all this shit happened to you, but it's made you who you are. Mm-hmm. And we love you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Absolutely.
Coming up next.
My name is Rick, and I found another dead body. There was blood everywhere. Everybody was running towards him. The first thing Scott says is, if I killed anybody again today. However you feel about what you're about to find out about me is none of my business.
Hi, Christine here. I wanted to come in for a moment and thank all of our listeners who have left 5-star reviews for our show on Apple Podcasts. Here's one that my producer gave me to read. What a great idea.
Thank you.
And who better to talk about finding dead bodies than a comedian? I love when Christine Levine is on my favorite podcast. Oh, God. She's so funny and entertaining. I swear I didn't write this myself. This podcast is going to be amazing. I look forward to hearing more episodes. Thanks, Christine. Oh, shucks. Oh, God. What a better way. A comedian. And then it's not funny. And then the podcast isn't funny. But they seem to enjoy it. Thank you so much to Chester Monroe for your review. You too can leave us a 5-star review, and we just might read it on the air in a future episode. And now, back to the show. Previously on Found Dead, we spoke to Rick. You might remember that he had found 6 dead bodies, and he's got our high score as far as guests go. Well, he's maintaining his lead, and don't worry, we'll get to that. But first, I wanted to hear what it's been like for Rick since his episodes came out.
So you are one of our most popular guests. I mean, you're popular with living people and popular with, I think, dead people too. Wouldn't you say that?
I assume so at this point.
It's not funny, but it's funny.
If it wasn't funny, it'd be terrible, right?
Right. Yeah. At this point, you do have to sort of joke about it. And I definitely think that you have a book or two to write about this. Because, again, this is like an odd phenomena that nobody would believe it. When I tell people that I have found multiple dead bodies, I get like side eye, like what? You know, right. I get a little suspicion, a little Murder, She Wrote jokes. Like, oh, yeah, Christine. Yeah. So they just magically appear every time you're right. around. That's convenient.
Yeah. When I go out and we see Scott and Barb, the first thing Scott says is if I killed anybody again today.
Is that hurtful or how does that make you feel?
It's not hurtful. I think in the long run, it, like we've talked about before, it brings attention to the situation and that people never talk about it. Mm-hmm. So if that's his way, if that's people's way of reaching out and saying something, then I guess it's good. I mean, I can take a poke here and there.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Yeah, if that's how they want to talk about it, or sometimes they'll have their own story that they want to share.
Right.
My son, Josh, he has his birthday on 9/11. And anytime somebody says, oh, well, so when's your birthday? What's your sign? And he goes, September 11th. I mean, it started off, you know, kind of funny, but then all of a sudden these people, strangers, are going into their own where were they origin story on the day of. They start off with some horrible tragedy. My son died. My dad's cousin died. Just always something. And I have a feeling that is what happens to me. That is what happens to you too.
For sure. Because I didn't talk about it before very often to anybody, I didn't know what to expect. So I think maybe there's a magnet there because it's so unusual to people. It may not be unusual in the world, but for people to hear it and to hear the way it has happened to me, the series of events is unique enough for people to actually want to say something to me. Even at work, somebody, you know, said something to me, a couple of things to me about it. And it's all kind of coming from different places and different people's different perspectives. I have to say, mostly people seem to be empathizing or flat out feeling sorry for me.
Whoa, how does that make you feel?
That makes me feel like I need to explain myself and say it's okay, you know, that my, you know, I've processed my life at this point, right? I'm okay, but I guess you need to deal with what you just found out about me.
Yeah, and then you are consoling them.
Yep, like, it's okay. This is a long time ago. It's all going to be okay. You don't need to worry about me. And that's probably the overwhelming sense I'm getting from people.
That is so interesting to me because you stated pretty explicitly about all of the therapy that you've been through and how you processed it. But the way you just said it, you just said, now you have to deal with what you learned about me.
Right. Like when it started happening, and you know, I don't talk about, you know, my prison experience very often. It's not necessary. So most of these people have never known about that, about me. So that is a shock to them because I don't present myself that way at all. So they had, especially at work, it's been a shock for people. Like when I posted it on social media, I said, however you feel about what you're about to find out about me is none of my business. You need to go deal with that on your own.
Wouldn't that have been nice if they had just read that and then, listened, heard you, kept it to themselves. He's right. I've got to deal with this.
Yes. I wish they had, but I'm okay with it. It's my life. It's my stuff I've had to deal with, my consequences for my life. I'm okay dealing with it. I'm not hurt by it or scared by it. I don't feel like I have to explain myself too much. You know, if I'm asked a specific question, I'll answer the specific question. But in general, I'm like, yeah, well, that's that. That's what it is.
You're so pragmatic and so like matter of fact about it. You can tell that you've done a lot of healing and you've come a long way.
I think this year has been a big, big part of it. I think sitting down with you earlier this year and then hearing it back for the first time. So I've never heard myself tell the story. I've also never told it in a full chronological order before. And to hear it in an hour, you know, in 2 25-minute stints was overwhelming at first. I think I've listened to it 30 times just to hear. First, I thought, gosh, this is so tragic. Why would I ever tell anybody about it? And then it was a process of grieving some things all over again for a little bit. And then it was like, okay, now we can just go forward and be like, it's all out there. There's nothing left. You know, I bared my whole soul. What can happen now, right?
Does it feel liberating now at all to you?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Because I don't have I don't have anything to worry about. I'm not worrying about what people might find out now. So for the last 15 plus years, I was always like, well, what if somebody finds out? Will they judge me different? Not just the prison thing, but even like six bodies, you know? So how are they going to judge me? It's a lot. And now whatever judgment they have, whoever has the brave or is brave enough to bring it to me, cool. Otherwise, again, it's none of my business. So it does feel good. Yeah.
So you and your husband, Sean, had an incident happen at work. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like of all the people for this to happen, it was just nuts. When you told me what happened, mm-hmm. I thought you were joking. I thought you were just, this was made up fantasy land. Oh, yeah. Right. Again. I'm sure you did.
Until I sent you pictures, right?
And then you sent pictures. Yeah. Okay. We're getting ahead of ourselves. Why don't you just tell me from the beginning what happened?
We were working. My husband and I work at the same place. And we were in a van, a cargo van, and we were coming back to our office. And we just moved to this office. It was there 1 week, I think. And as we were coming around the corner, somebody, a homeless man, had right then been shot in the head and had just fallen to the ground. And as we came around the corner, everybody was running towards him. And I sort of slowed down. It was really obvious. There was blood everywhere. And I started to slow down to stop. And I saw all these other people coming and I just kept driving.
Right?
Yep.
Just like I've had to ask every guest so far, like, and what did you do? Did you think about leaving? Did you want to leave? But I know that with your experience, because this has happened so many times, you knew exactly where this was going to go. And it was going to be
a day ruiner.
They would have made you sit there. Where were you? They would have gotten your fingerprints. They would have crawled up your ass and your husband's and just tried to dissect your whole life right there.
Right. We went back to the office. And then a little while later, the detectives were kind of going door to door. You know what I mean? And so when they came they came and rang the doorbell and I just, you know, made myself scarce. I didn't want to talk to anybody.
Well, they had plenty of other people, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They just wanted to see if anybody saw anything. I know that they caught the bad guy within a couple of hours. What was kind of sad about it is we drove by to leave to go home about 4 hours later and he was still there. They hadn't finished processing anything yet. So
there is a little bit of an indignity that they don't work a little faster. They always seem to be so casual. Every time I've seen a scene like that, they just kind of stand around. They talk about, I imagine their families, like, how you doing, Bob? I'm good. Did you find out what happened exactly? Like, what was this about?
Just through the grapevine, it was basically the two homeless men were having a confrontation of some sort, and one pulled out a gun, and that was it. It was over for that guy. Just like that. Yeah.
What could that fight have been about?
Drugs,
I know. I was just going to say, I always think about drugs because that is the one thing that makes people crazy.
Crazy. Yeah. That's what I assumed. Like that's what I assumed immediately. And actually to follow up on what you were saying about them standing around, it was weird. We passed by and it was just like three patrol cars with cops sitting in them. Nobody was even outside. They were just sitting in the cars. It was hot. And most likely waiting for the coroner, whoever, the morgue people to come.
Yeah, they have to sit and wait. So this would be like your seventh body and then your husband's first?
It is his first experience, yes.
How was that for him? How's he doing?
I think he's fine. He doesn't seem all that affected by it for right now. I don't know. He talked about it some. He talked about the blood and that he was laying flat on his face. I think that affected him a little bit, but not that, you know. Plus, I've told him a million stories and been very detailed on some things, so maybe I desensitized him a bit.
I actually think you probably have.
Right,
That kind of does help when you have a partner that's gone through a lot of trauma. Your partner kind of goes through that with you.
Yeah.
They feel it, too, in a way. So what do you think? Is this a coincidence? What is it?
You said last time that, do I think that it's people are drawn because they can handle it. I thought about that a lot after you said that. And I don't know. I don't know if it's just really bad luck or if that's the case. To be 100% honest, I don't know that I could have handled it if I got out of the car this time. It might have been just too much because we had just done this recording, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
and
everything else was really, really fresh for you.
Yeah, and I, you know, and to do the first sit down with you, I had to like bring a lot of stuff up before I came to talk to you, and I had to write notes down because of that therapy, you know what I mean, that pushes things back to that long-term memory. So I had to take some time to make sure I had everything right, and you know, and make sure I wasn't going to do it out of order or anything like that.
I'd never sat down with somebody who had so much to talk about like that. Like it was hard to listen to, especially, but I love you so much. And just to see the pain on such a scale like that and
right.
have it one after the other, you know, you don't really get that, you know, when you're with your friends, I don't think, or people that you love in your life where they dump it all, or, and that wasn't even all. I mean, that's not like all of your trauma. That's just what we're talking about in this particular subject matter.
Right.
And it was very painful to hear that you'd been through all that. It explains a lot about what kind of man you are, what kind of friend you are, what kind of, you know, husband you are, and that you're so remarkable and so kind and sweet, but also tough.
Right. Well, like, you're going to make me cry, and that's not good.
Oh, I'm doing my best Barbara Walters. But it's all true. Right. It's all true. Like that really explained a lot about your character to me, and I love you very much. And man, let's just go 1 year with no dead people, shall we? Let's just that.
Yeah, we can. We'll try. It was a couple years, you know, between the last one and this one. So, you know, but like you said, the whole rest of the trauma is something that has nothing to do with this subject matter, right? No matter what, you have to work through. I think we talked about it before about violence and prison. And, you know, you and I have talked about it on personally, just about the living on the edge every day, sleeping with one eye open, so to speak, and how that translates into the real world and how it doesn't fit out here. And that trauma is something that will always be there. You can't erase it. You can't not look over your shoulder. You just can't. It's just the way it goes.
Yeah. You don't think that you're ever going to be able to relax, do you?
Mm-mm. No. I try, you know, I really do. I try to find my safe places and stuff. And I really haven't found one place where I can just take a deep breath and feel safe. Like even at home, if I hear, you know, the door creak or something, I'm on high alert. It's just such conditioning and so many years of it to reverse it or to change it. I mean, even my therapist was like, there are just some things that are going to be the way they are.
Of all the people that I know that deserve to feel safe 24/7, you are at the top of my list, babe. And I'm sorry, you definitely deserve that. Everybody does, but you especially.
No, thank you.
You're a good goddamn person, man.
So are you.
Well, we do our best. I want to know what you think happens after we die. Do you think there's an afterlife or heaven?
So I don't believe in any of that. That's the simple answer. I think that you just cease to exist. I think that though death is just like before you were born, nothing. I used to really want it to be something. I used to really think it was going to be something. And I think my experiences taught me that, in my humble opinion, that people use it to make themselves feel better. I don't see, I mean, everything dies and that's it, right? So I don't know why it would be special for us.
That's what makes me feel better about my experiences, is that just knowing that it's natural and normal. Everybody's going to die. Everything is going to die, and it is okay. And sometimes they're going to die right in front of you, or you're going to be hiking along and you're going to find somebody who had a bad day. And it's weird, and it's kind of like, to you. But the truth is, it's totally normal.
Right.
And even to people like me and you who have had repeated over and over and over again, have run into these kinds of situations. You know what? It's totally normal for us too.
Right.
And you're right. Why would it be different for us? We're animals too. And it just makes sense. How weird is it that we have this idea that if something dies in a place, then that person and their consciousness doesn't get to leave there?
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
It is weird. It's weird, and it's hard for me to comprehend. Like I was saying, there was a time where I really wanted to believe in it, and I like got really into like reading the books from the mediums, you know, the famous mediums, and
the
John Edwards and the Sylvia Browns and all of them. And you know, right now it's that Tyler person and Teresa Caputo or whatever, and I'll watch it, but then I'll catch them doing their little tricks. And I've been in a hospice room where somebody passed away, and the room feels different. But I don't know that it actually feels different. It feels different to us because something changed, right? Like, you know,
right.
Something
happened. Yeah.
So we feel different. Therefore, no matter what, the energy in the room feels different.
I don't know. I mean, I've walked like when I found the dead guy at the porn store, I did not think that he was dead because they usually weren't. Mm-hmm. But the second I cracked that door open, I unlocked it with the key, and the second I just pushed it open a little bit and I saw his, there's just the side of his shoulder, I was like, he's dead. There's something about a dead thing, a body, a meat sack that stopped pumping air. Listen, human beings, we have to, in order for us to have survived this long and avoided saber-tooth tigers or getting eaten and destroyed or whatever, and living like animals, there's a part of us that has to be able to instinctually smell it, feel it, sense it, something.
Yeah.
There has to be like some kind of way we can do that. But is it supernatural?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that it's spiritual or supernatural. I think that it's probably natural. It's probably instinct. I'll clear something up there too. Like, I think science has proved energy doesn't cease to exist, right? Everything's energy gets, you know, brought back into the universe one way or another. So I believe that's true, but I can also point to science on that too. I used to wait for the butterfly for my grandma, all that stuff, but I'm not that person anymore.
I know what you mean. I want to believe in that stuff too. I want it so bad. I will hold on to seeing a hummingbird or a dragonfly or any kind of sign from somebody that I love, and I'll hold on to it. I want it so bad, but the truth is, the logical person in me, the other side just goes, this makes no sense. How could that even be? And then even though, you know, we go, okay, energy can't be destroyed. Fair enough. It can't be. I accept that. But it doesn't stay. It's not in the container anymore.
Right.
So it dissipates. It degrades. Yeah. It goes, it turns into something else, but not necessarily a ghost.
The consciousness of somebody.
Whatever this computer inside of us, whatever's making us tick, that energy does go away, but it transfers into something that will, you know, grow plants or mushrooms or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Goes back into the ground.
I think what we do as humans is we attach so much to our loved ones, right? And I do it too. But for me, their memory and keeping what they've taught me and what I remember about them, the good stuff, the bad stuff, whatever, that is how they live on, not in some religious aspect or some spiritual aspect.
They live on in our memories.
In our memories, yeah.
How do you want to die?
I've thought about this often. I think I mentioned it before that because of all the stuff that's happened in my life, I was very afraid to die for a very long time. I would get anxiety attacks just thinking about it. Obviously, for me, I think the best way to die would just be like, boom, I got hit by a truck and it'd be done. I don't know how the rest of my people would feel about that, but that for me would be like the best way. Or 50% of me wants it just to be instant and it happens. 50% of me wants to actually like kind of get to a place to where I just am sick or old and want to die.
Because then it's a relief. It's a relief for you, but also it's a relief for everybody else.
Right. So maybe I can just accept my mortality at that point instead of worrying about it. I don't know, maybe get to that point where like I'm so tired and my body hurts so much and I'm in a wheelchair and I'm 90 and I just want to die. Maybe I want to feel like that. But mostly, maybe I just want to fall asleep and not wake up.
Yeah, I don't want to be scared. That's
right.
Whatever way I go, I want to not have a bunch of fear.
I don't want to be afraid of it. That's exactly right. Yeah.
That's why I was afraid to fly for a really long time. Not because I was afraid of the crash or, you know, the crash isn't the problem. It's the 3-4 minutes before it hits the ground or the water. That is the problem. Yeah. And when my father-in-law, ex-father-in-law, whatever, my ex-husband's dad passed away, that is watching him. He had cancer, and watching him be scared was a nightmare.
Hmm.
And to be honest with you, he did not die like bravely. He fought it. He was upset. He was scared. He was all legitimate feelings. He was angry. And it was weird. Like when he called his friends, would call and just check on him, I guess, and say, "Hey, how are you doing?" And he would say, "What do you mean, how am I doing? I'm going to be dead in 2 weeks. What are you doing? Hmm. What are you talking to me about?" He was so pissed off.
Yeah.
And you can't really go, "Hey, you're kind of being a dick to everybody right now. Can you just reel it in a little bit?" But it did teach me something, that if I get to that point where it is my turn and that's just how it's going to happen to me, I hope I remember that it is not about me at that point. It is no longer about me. And it is about the people I leave behind. And I do not want to make them scared, even if I am scared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, you've got your kids that you know, your nieces and nephews and stuff that you've got to protect.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what I'm talking about.
Right.
You know that your instinct is to make sure that they are okay. Your family is okay first, even above yourself. I know you're like that.
Right.
That's what I think. Like, if it ever does get to be your turn and something has to happen like that, I think that you are absolutely going to rise to that occasion, and you'll put your fear away for their sake, if not for anything else. You'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably. I probably want to be mad.
You will want to be mad. Yeah, of course.
Right.
Of course, but we're just going to eat that shit sandwich and go down with the ship. Fine.
That's right. That's right. I didn't think I was going to make it out of my situation alive before, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought that I had a greater chance of not making it out alive. So there was a lot of thought about that, a lot of fear, like fear that you couldn't show. You know?
Oh, yeah, because every day for those 8 years, you were, and that's a long time to spin the wheel.
Yeah, yeah, long time. Every day. Every day. And it changes you fundamentally, you know.
Oh, that kind of stress has to change your DNA.
Yeah, yeah, I believe so. Yeah, it changes you in every part of you, every part of your psyche. I think it even changes your body. And how you physically interact in the world.
How you hold yourself.
Mm-hmm. How you look at people in parking lots, how you see somebody walk through a door, you know.
Yeah, you cannot ever relax.
Mm-mm. Someday. Someday when they tell me I'm dying.
I can be like, finally.
Finally.
This was a hard interview for me. All of them are challenging in their own way, but Rick is different. We're close friends. It occurred to me that we don't have conversations like this, especially as adults. Kids will say whatever comes to their minds, but as adults, we recognize that probably people don't want to talk about it. You know, whatever their it is. But when a close friend comes to you and wants to tell you something, and like, you know, it's going to be heavy, we still often end up avoiding it. We're too busy. We've got our own stuff going on, or, you know, it's just too much. There are times that I don't even return a phone call because I know it's going to take a lot of time. And for a conversation like this, you need to make mental and emotional space, and you need time. If it wasn't for doing this podcast, I wouldn't even have had this conversation with Rick. I mean, I'm being honest here, because it seemed like too much. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to know, but now I'm so glad I did. I think we should have these conversations more often, because I do want to know. I want to know what my friends and my family have been through, and what made them the people I love today. It's not easy, it can be draining, but it's important, and it's worth it.
Found Dead is a Levine Entertainment production.
This show is produced and edited by Nora Williams. Our logo is by Nora Williams, based on a design by Chris Levine. Our theme music is Autumn Sunset by Jason Shaw. The interview you heard today was edited for length and clarity. If you found someone dead and would like to tell your story, reach out to us through email at founddeadpod@gmail.com. Or you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at FoundDeadPod.
Let's just say this for legalities. Nora, check our lawyer. Make sure they know.
Right? I didn't kill anyone.
You didn't make them one.
Mm-mm.
Not one of them.
No.
Mm-hmm. Oh. I love you so much. Wait. I'm stuck. I love you, babe. Thank you for sharing this stuff with me. I'm going to get some
opioids. Oh, I need painkillers.
I cannot believe you saw another dead person. I cannot believe. I mean, and a violent one too. It's just. Oh no, I shouldn't have done that with my head. I'm sorry. I meant mind blown. My head exploded.
There's the stand-up comedian.